Good morning and welcome. As all of us in this room know, but we stress it because we may forget the importance of it, the bond between students of Theosophy and between the various United Lodges is one and the same thing. It is independent devotion. That means that the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia is autonomous. Its own students decide the schedule, decide what subjects will be addressed. It is not a branch of anything. It is its own. But all the United Lodges are working together on the basis of the same policy and on the basis of that independent devotion. It's not an organization. It's an association of students working together to give out Theosophy as found in the original writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge. Therefore, it has none of the structures or strictures of an organization. No constitution, no bylaws, no officers, no dues, no fees. And it makes no distinction as to gender or background or even organization. All are welcome. And of course, it is always totally free. We do not pass the hat. We do not require any sort of tuition but your attention. That's it. However, because we live in a world of material things, money is always necessary. If you can only give a dollar, give a dollar. But if you feel these ideas are important and this location for giving out those ideas, then support it in some way. The schedule for April, May, and June is available, and this week coming up is probably the busiest week we have ever had at the Philadelphia ULT. This Wednesday night, which the reference library is 5:30 to 7:30, and then our study class in the Ocean of Theosophy begins at 7:45 and lasts till 9. That's Wednesday night. Then Friday night, we have our monthly third Friday of the month Comparative Religion Philosophy study class. The doors open at 6, the meeting is 7 to 8, and the title for Friday, April 15th is Taoism, The Quiet Way. Then on Saturday, April 16th from 1 to 3:30, right here in the lodge, we will be having a forum entitled What You Don't Know About Karma. And there's a handout on the table behind the usher that will give you the various titles, and there'll be time for questions, answers, and discussion. It should be a very interesting meeting. And then on Sunday, we have our regular Sunday morning meeting, 11 to 12, and the title under the heading Spiritual Knowledge is The Little Universe Called Man. Now, our subject this morning is this isn't funny. I've just lost all my notes. And they're full of quotes. Would you see if it's on the table out there? Yeah, it's a good thing this isn't one of those things, you know, like where at a safety award show, the person has an accident on the way. Thank you. This isn't like that. I'm not talking about why intelligence. Our subject this morning under spiritual knowledge, thank you, is why life, why me? And this question, the why of life, may be the most serious question we ever ask in our lives. And at some point, everyone does ask it. But Most people have come to the conclusion that life is chance. That they either accept the theory of the Big Bang, that a germ fortuitously landed here on this planet and development spread from there. It was the germ of something, and no one knows what, and it was chance. Life began by accident. That is the commonly held belief. Now, we wonder what most people would say if they ever saw a copy of Life magazine from May 1949, which had an insert of a 16-page primer for the layman about the atom. That Life magazine always did focus on the latest scientific ideas and explaining it to the rest of us. In this particular article, they printed the table of the elements, and statements about that table of the elements that point to the fact that this is a universe of intelligence, of beauty and order in its expression. It also points to the fact that whether we know it or not, scientists were and are aware that the theory that matter is blindly in control of everything is false. Scientists know that, but perhaps they hide behind other ideas so as not to be ridiculed or challenged. Anyway, you may certainly come up here after and look at this amazing table of the elements. Now, what we're going to read you is from the text below the table. But first, we're going to talk about the basic order of this table. The order of the elements is based on the number of electrons in the elements. Hydrogen has one electron, so it's first. Helium has two, so it's second. Lithium, three, and so on around the spiral. This mathematical progression is because of the reality of the number of electrons. It's not something that was made up by the scientists, and it's not something to make it easier for us to understand it. It is fact. It is a numerical progression. As a matter of fact, the gentleman who first came up with this recognition predicted the numbers of the next elementals because it was easy. It's numerical, and he's been proven correct. We're going to read from some of this. The colors represent another relationship in addition to the number of electrons. The repetition at regular intervals of the chemical properties of the first few. I saw a frown. Regular intervals of the same properties. It's also characteristics repeated periodically from the simplest to the most complex. And the last statements. In expressing this relationship between the elements, this is the scientist telling us, the table reveals the extraordinary symmetry and order which underlie the universe. That's an astonishing statement. What could that be, chance? Could it be some sort of accidental or natural occurrence? If you walked into a room and everything in that room had been sorted according to size and use and the number of them, would you think it happened by itself? Or would you say, oh, someone's been here and did that? intelligence was used to create this order. So what does theosophy say in answer to this question, why life? Well, it certainly honors what the scientists have shown in that table of the elements. But the first thing theosophy does is ask more questions. And that's what we need to learn to do. Instead of accepting an idea, ask more questions about it to see if the idea is worth holding. In the Vedas, who verily knows and who can declare it, whence it was born, and whence comes this creation? The gods are later than this whole world's production. Who knows then whence it first came into being? He, the origin of this creation, whether he formed it all or did not form it, whose eye controls this world in highest heaven, he verily knows it, or perhaps he knows it not. And its conclusion is, it is a God seeking to realize itself in itself. Now, if you've ever read the Upanishads, which our pundits say was written about 2,500 years ago, and theosophy says is far, far older, the Upanishads ask the following questions. What is the cause of this universe? Whence do we come? Why do we live? The Svetasvara-tara and other Upanishads all begin in this simple way. Time, space, law, chance, matter, energy, intelligence. Is it all chance? Is it a blind concurrence of atoms? Is it energy? Is it mind? There have been some thinkers who have answered these questions in accord with the Upanishads, in accord with the ancient wisdom. The British botanist George James Allen, addressing the scientists in England, said, no physical hypothesis founded on any indisputable fact has yet explained the origin of the primordial protoplasm, and above all, its marvelous properties, which render evolution possible. For these properties are the cause and not the effect of evolution. 200 years later, Carl Sagan, an American astronomer, in his wonderful documentary, a long series on television called Cosmos, he said, the beauty of a living thing is not the atoms that go into it, but the way those atoms are put together. The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are a way for the cosmos to know itself. Without a subject, there is no object, said the Buddha. Without an observer, there is no object. Without consciousness, there is no universe. Subject and object are interdependent and cannot be separated. They are the same thing. The observer, then, is the universe. So wonderful things to think about. They will stretch your mind. It'll feel like it's hurting your mind, but it's good for you. So when we look upward into the universe then sees itself. Going further back, Jacob Burma wrote that deity seeks to become thing and know itself, to project itself into actuality and consciousness. The no thing seeks to become something. Yeats wrote, the Irish poet, like Jacob Burma and the occultists, William Blake postulates a fourth principle, a universal matrix or heaven, from which and in which we all have life. The matrix may be described as the imagination of God, without which neither Father nor Son nor Spirit could be made manifest in life. And then Plotinus, he declares that the One is alone with itself and ineffable, that it subsists by thinking of itself as itself. The intellect subsists through thinking, and here's our problem. The intellect subsists through thinking itself as other, and therefore becomes divided within itself. Theosophy teaches us that the source of life is one, an infinite, unknowable, changeless principle. Because we are all one within that principle, we are all one with all of life. But it is infinite, and we, in our consciousness, are finite. So we can't know it, even though we are it. So we are told to use the idea of space, because space is beginningless and endless, because we can't conceive of anything that isn't in space, within space, and has space within it. But when we come to the action of life, we realize that it moves cyclically, that it is the expression of periodical law. Most commonly, we recognize this cyclic activity as the law of karma, action and reaction, cause and effect. So if we take these two fundamental ideas, we are left with the further question. You have that one infinite source, that expression of it under law that comes periodically, which all leads to the next question, evolution, or why me?
And me. Yeah. Well, now that we've looked at the broader question, we have to consider the more narrow question, or as Theosophy would say, we're going to go from the universals to the particulars. The third proposition of the philosophy of Theosophy is the identity of all souls with the Oversoul, and the obligatory pilgrimage of these rays of the One Reality through a long series of incarnations. Pure spirit can gain individual self-consciousness only after it has passed through every form of life, from the lowest forms clear up to the highest intelligences of the universe. This pilgrimage is accomplished first by the onward impetus given it at its start, which carries it through all the lower planes of nature, from when man, which is you and I at this point, it awakes to self-conscious intelligence. From now on, the soul's evolution must be carried on by self-devised effort. The obligatory pilgrimage of the soul is sometimes called the cycle of necessity, for the soul is forced by virtue of its own nature, by the impetus given it, to work its way onward and upward until it at last finds reunion with its source. There can be no such thing as giving up. What is not accomplished now will have to be done at another time. The soul is compelled to keep on its journey until it has earned the privilege of conscious reuniting with the Oversoul. The understanding of our own real nature is essential because it is this understanding that when gained will determine the purpose of our life. And on it, the actions that we shall take. Those that look upon themselves as mere body will minister to the lower, personal, animal self and make it the be-all and end-all of life. They will concentrate all their energies and all of their efforts on those beings or on those things in life that do not matter. But those that know that they are in essence immortal beings, emanations of the one spiritual consciousness, will not act as such. They know that wealth, possessions, and the lower desires will have to be left at their death, because these things do not adhere to the spirit in man. And realizing this, they will feel an essential in the words, it essential in the words of Mr. Judge, to minister to the needs of the inner man. However, mere intellectual acceptance of such a directive is certainly not enough. We must dwell on it every day, day in, day out. Every thought and therefore every action must conform to it. The purpose of our life then is to learn to discern the real from the false, to stop making the lower personal self the center of our consciousness and realizing our identity with the one self. We are pilgrims on a pilgrimage through material life in a quest of conscious realization of our innate divinity and perfection. So how do we proceed with this great goal? Which, by the way, is the same goal for everyone, though the means will be different for each individual. It is by learning through the reaping of what we have sown, gaining fresh knowledge and powers in each life. Life is all about learning. It is commonly said that life is a school where each experience is a lesson for the soul. And we must pass through every trial, every grade in that school, thus bringing about total development of the soul. This learning obviously doesn't happen overnight. The process is slow. But when looked at as a series of incarnations during which the soul learns and develops, receiving its just due, then life takes on a greater meaning. Thus, an understanding of karma and reincarnation is most important, for it endows life with a sacred purpose. We must strive for knowledge and strength and prepare ourselves by study and otherwise in order to be able to help and teach others. Not in order that we may climb above others and have them serve us, as is a common goal. Our purpose is not to reach perfection ourselves, but to help our fellow pilgrims do likewise. Without true sacrifice, life loses its real meaning. For only in the service of others do we touch the deepest springs of our own existence. It is only when we take life as a grand and noble opportunity to serve our fellow man, that we shall make it what it should be. To those below us, we can give help. And from those on a higher rung on the ladder of life, we can obtain assistance and guidance. The goal may seem far removed. At the present, we can only reach out to it with the mind. Full understanding can only come with perfect achievement. So where shall we begin? The starting point is within ourselves. It is a change in the mental attitude. It is imperative that we think aright. From the Gita, each man is of the same nature as that ideal on which his faith is fixed. To right thought, we must add right effort. All we have to do is to live in the best way we can. Wherever we find ourselves, we are not to abandon the small, plain duties of life. The Gita says, the devotee who is engaged in the right practice of his duties approaches the Supreme Spirit in no long time. And again from the Gita, perfection is attained by devotion to natural duty. As human beings, we evolve our latent capacities through cycles of reincarnation. In this light, death is not an ending, but a different state of existence. As a natural, a part of the rhythm of human life, as is birth. Our inner core is an indestructible atom of the spiritual heart of the universe. Through our myriad transformations of consciousness and form, we always remain expressions of the essential selfhood, creating our character and destiny by our own action or karma. Action and reaction function on all planes, and today we are the summation of everything we have been and done throughout eons long past. It is our responsibility and opportunity to meet positively the results of our past and so continue to grow, expanding our consciousness and sympathies. Then this is our true spiritual heritage, not books or ideas or monuments, but the love and sympathy we share for all and with all. Indeed, when our experience and love become too great for human expression, when our conscious link to our inner God becomes too powerful for an imperfect form to contain it, then truly we pass out of the limitations of this human temple and ascend to the brotherhood of the gods. Your questions are invited.
Yes.
Just a comment, really. If you can get a hold of the book, A Child is Born, which is a lot of photography of the inside of the womb while the fetus is developing, you can compare those pictures to the pictures of the Milky Way, the galaxy, and you're struck with the absolute identical environment of the sky overhead and the womb around the unborn child.
We recall seeing a photograph of flares from the sun, and if you look at a picture of the egg being fertilized, the same action is taking place. It is all one life. One process. Yes. His hand was up first.
You mentioned that within life itself there's a natural impulse to move forward. And we think that perhaps this time of year is, again, the expression of that, that we're always reminded that there is that impulse. As a human being, don't we need to, I think what we express is that we need to become or realize that more completely in our life and how to express that.
Yeah, we do indeed. I lost my thought.
I'll jump in.
Go ahead, go ahead.
Then you jump in.
All right.
The funny thing is, we do realize it, but we realize it for our everyday mundane duties. We know we have to set up the right causes at work. We know we have to do certain things in our home. Or if we don't, we won't be able to open the door. It'll be all dirty clothes and dirty dishes. So we already recognize the need for right thought, right action. What we lose is the idea in the importance of right motive, right heart, right awareness of our real nature. So we have the skill. We just use it externally.
Yeah, in the little thing I just read, the phrase, think aright, and with right action, attitude, mm-hmm. motive is the key.
The expression that all life is probationary, you mean this whole planet, our whole existence, the whole seven rounds and seven races, and that figure with, what is it, 13 figures or 16, we forget. It's just this vast, vast theory of evolution. It's all probationary and...
But for whom? It isn't probationary for the lower kingdoms. They're very busily learning what they need to do in their particular level of awareness. It is probationary for the thinker, that is us, as spiritual beings. It is the thinker who joins forces with the lower kingdoms in the human form. And in doing so, spirit and matter meet for the first time in the human mind. Spirit can't know itself, as we kept mentioning from these quotes. In order for spirit to know itself, it needs something. Just like in order for you to see yourself, you have to have something to mirror you back. It's the same principle. You can't see yourself. Once the thinker has joined in the human form, there's that duality, because the thinker also sees matter and lives through matter. And our problem is we are focused incorrectly instead of looking within to the spiritual nature. So the probation is, what will we learn from our own thinking and acting? And the problem is we don't learn until we realize that this present difficulty belongs to me because of something I created in some life, in some manner. It's mine. It's mine to deal with. And when I do, I will grow and find other opportunities. You're on probation too, right?
Yeah, absolutely on probation. I'm not going to add anything to that.
Oh, okay, yes.
I'm a little confused on the observer and the observed.
Mm-hmm.
As you observe, you're changing what's observed. The observer is changing what's observed. I'm a little like...
Well, there is that in the scientific community. They say you cannot observe anything without affecting it to some degree because there's an exchange of energy. But the basic idea is there is no universe without someone to observe it. And Mr. Crosby has a wonderfully simple way. Close your eyes. No, do. Close your eyes. Where is everything? Where is everyone? It doesn't exist except in your own memory and consciousness. In other words, there is no universe for you without you participating in it. So, yes, we change what we observe, but what changes more is the ideas and the basis on which we act. Yes?
But isn't that what we are told to do? To look at ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Observe ourselves. And by that observation alone, we begin to change because we are aware of an aspect of ourselves that we've never really paid attention to before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like if you don't know what's wrong, you can't fix it.
Exactly.
You know, so it's like if it's not broke, don't fix it. But we're all broke, and we all need fixing. So we have to take a good look to see exactly where to apply the fixes.
But that change doesn't happen except that we participate in it. It isn't just by observing it. We have to declare that we're going to do it and then take the steps to make it happen. Yes?
Isn't that the basis for meditation? The idea that we observe ourselves and observe our surroundings seriously and mindfully?
Yes, in a way, but that's more concentration. Plato's definition of meditation is the inward turning of the soul towards the divine. In other words, the letting go of all that's observed that has given us our basis for our intelligence and our use of substance, but to surrender that and realize there is a connection which we cannot observe, we can only participate in. Yes?
These ideas, when we think about them from hearing them, they are very logical. A use of common sense makes them make sense. But yet, these ideas are, in a way, cut off because, especially in the West, of the religious and the scientific influence we've had since little children. So we're wondering, we can see why it's had the hindrance on it. We're just wondering, how would you get someone to think outside their little box of these ideas?
Well, I guess from early on, you're told that you can't do anything on your own. You need the blessing of a church somewhere or a specific person at that church in order for you to accomplish anything. And that if you make a mistake, don't worry about it. You can pray that away, or you can have somebody pray for you and they can take it away. Theosophy says, no, none of that is the way to go. You have to do it on your own. Everyone must do their own duty as it is before them.
But at the same time, Theosophy is not seeking to take away anyone's religious faith, but to look into that religion, study it, see that it's based on the same great ideas, even though it may have turned some of them into dogmatic ideas, like take the Lord's Prayer and look at the Lord's Prayer in a different way. Look at it as a spiritual document. See if there's wisdom in it. Do that with everything that you come across. Now, science basically was a natural reaction to the strictures and condemnation of religion against thought, against using common sense. So it's natural that it built up the way it did. What's unnatural at this point is we have basic humans thinking the authority of science is absolute, and then the scientists, many of them within that, knowing that what they're giving out is not true, is not based on fact, but unwilling to disturb all of that and going on with their researches. Yes?
It's definitely not wise to directly challenge someone's religious beliefs.
It's not kind either.
It's not kind, it's not wise. But if done in the right way, you might make them thirsty or curious. But it has to be done very gently and without any judgment at all or any attitude of, well, I know this and you don't. Or, you know, it's hard, it's difficult to make somebody thirsty for knowledge, to really want to do the search themselves. But that's the only way it's going to be accomplished anyway.
How did Socrates do that? by asking the right questions. He didn't tell them things.
But he also really annoyed a lot of people, too.
Well, that's no, truly, that's a mystery. And if you are interested in it, read in The Secret Doctrine. We are told that the reason he was called upon to commit suicide was a very occult one. So there's a great mystery there. But the fact is that if you can provoke someone to think about what they think they know, they have an opening to learn differently. It isn't that we're trying to convince them. Yes?
We want to provoke them to think without provoking a bloody nose from them.
Well, we may deserve one. Yes.
You mentioned the Lord's Prayer, and the title of the subject this morning is Why Life? Why Me? In the Lord's Prayer, it says, lead us not into temptation.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, we're born into Maya, which is temptation. Mm-hmm. Could you address that?
Well, you know, the lead us not into temptation is a plea from a soul that is on the spiritual path of development. It merely says, don't push me any harder than I'm being pushed right now. You know, I would never think of embezzling from the place where I work. But suppose I were in a position where I could embezzle 10 million. Well, that might tempt me. I might, yeah, I could escape by my own island. They'd never find me. Don't lead me into that kind of temptation. Let me get stronger before I have to face these difficult, difficult choices. Everything in the Lord's Prayer is part of spiritual development, spiritual growth for the individual. How do we handle the temptations we now have? We usually have an argument with ourselves and end up doing the things we wanted to do and not the things we knew we shouldn't do. Did you want to speak on that? No.
We're just thinking about that idea of change. Now, we know science is constantly changing different, you know, theory of this, theory of that. We know that in the strictest sense of the religious or priestcraft quote we could use, there are things that, like, always it was in Latin, it's now being changed or has been changed. So we're wondering about this idea of change. Those two symbols, that of religion and science, has always been the basic background, but they're always changing. You know, they're finding new things. Whereas these ancient teachings
don't have to change.
They don't change.
But they don't have to change. Why does science change? Because they discover another new fact that throws their theory off. You know, HPB says in The Secret Doctrine that it's not science and the scientific process that theosophy or theosophists would argue with. It's the conclusions that they reach based on the little bit of evidence that they have. Instead of reaching a limited conclusion, they make a sweeping broad one, and then we end up with the idea that matter is all there is. It's the only reality. So it isn't the process that's wrong. And religion changes because it starts to lose face or value with the people. So they have to make it modern or approach and appeal to them in a different way.
Yeah, science says that every conclusion they reach is correct. Believe it.
Yeah.
That's the fact. Well, theosophy doesn't say that. Theosophy says check, test, and verify. That's from science. That's what scientists do. They check, test, and verify. They just have their facts incorrect because they change. And if they weren't incorrect, the premises that they check, test, and verify, they would come out with a different conclusion, and they wouldn't jam it down the textbooks and in our children.
Way in the back.
Well, both my groups of thinkers, whether you have a very competitive, argumentative scientist who's convinced, or whether you have a dogmatic theologian, they're both centered on outside sources of information and outside sources of authority. Whereas in the ancient line of thinking, thinking of the end of the Gita, for instance, where it's act as seemest best to thou. The onus is placed on the role of the individual, not the little special me, but the I, the eternal, with the universal, and that's the active basis, that relationship.
You know, it's if we could just get the picture in our minds that we are absolutely identical to each other. The only difference is, personalizing it this way because we don't know any other way to express it, I am sitting here and I see the universe from here. You're there and you're there and you're there. You see a different universe because you're in a different place, but also because our experience colors our understanding of what we see. It's an explanation that's used in dreaming, that a symbol in a dream means one thing to a peasant and another to a prince. So we are identical. We have the same powers of thought, will, feeling, memory, imagination, but over 18 million years, we have each used them differently. And this is the why of life. When this period of evolution ends and we return into that unity, we bring to each other all of those experiences. In other words, there is this incredible assimilation of what has been experienced by ourselves as thinkers in becoming one again. Yes?
Well, only it would seem that the answer is in the question.
I can't hear you.
The answer must be in the question, because what does it take for an individual to even ask the question?
Well, they have to have a degree of intelligence on the right subjects to ask guided and intelligent questions to begin with. It doesn't mean that they get an answer and they're going to do anything with that answer, but it is food for thought for them, right? Yes.
But this is what we were asking. Is not the answer in the question? And if so, why has it been presented here in these rooms?
I think you lost me with that question. But if we could go back for 1 second.
I think he's correlating the...
We think you can ask a stupid question. It's allowed. I've been asking them all my life. You can ask a stupid question if you're sincere. You really don't understand something. Like, we recall not too many years ago saying to someone, you know, cucumbers and pickles, they look just alike. And they thought we were an idiot. Well, nobody ever told us. Why didn't they call them cucumber pickles? Then we would have understood. So we think you can be stupid and still ask questions that have value and that become valuable to you. The point is, we're usually too embarrassed to say, I don't know. We had a friend who used to make a snap judgment about people with a very quick and easy thing. He would use a word he had made up totally and make it part of a reasonable sentence. And when the person nodded their head, listening, he'd go, no, that's phony. I don't want to waste my time with that person. He would make friends with the person who said, that word you just used, what does it mean? And then he would go, I respect this person. They're aware and they're not embarrassed to admit they don't know something. So questions are vital. Yes.
Pointing out the way, our duty here is to keep this torch lit.
Yes.
So that when questions are asked, we are to show the person or show the people, who am I? That goes along with this question of why life, why me? Then we begin to teach them to look within yourself. Who is the questioner asking the question?
But somebody has to want to do that. You were going to come.
No, well, I thought he was correlating the effect being part of the cause.
Yes. No, we go with newcomers first.
What I'm getting at with the title of, you know, Why Life, Why Me, I'm getting to the point of thinking in my mind that it's more to me than who I think I am.
Yes.
It's more to me. I've gotten often labeled into some labels, but those are only labels.
And who is the label maker? You, as a consciousness. You label things, I like this, I don't like that. I agree with this, I don't agree with that. But we do it as an automatic thing instead of going, why do I like this and not like that? Why do I agree with this and not agree with that? There's something huge right there. I have the right to inspect it and decide for myself. When we say me, we usually mean this me. But we know every night when we go to sleep, there's something else going on. And not just the deep sleep state, which we don't usually remember, but in dreams, we see and know things that we don't see and know consciously right here and now. There's a deeper me that begins to come out. And we are told to start practicing the recollection of dreams, writing things down, not talking about them to people, but collecting them and seeing for ourselves, as Job says in the Bible, in dreams and visions of the night, we are instructed. We are spiritual beings in a physical body. So yes, there's much more to me than me. Did you come to?
No.
Oh, well, you pick one of them. I'm not.
In the back.
Two backs.
Two backs.
This conversation is wonderful, and it would have been really interesting to see if we just changed one word in the title. Why, instead of why me, why I? Would have changed it, would have shifted it to a whole nother perspective. Maybe we can do that at a later date.
Well, we think it was addressed in the earlier part. Yes.
Would it get complicated, but we're getting around to subject and object.
Yes, as the Buddha said, without the one, there isn't the other.
The other. And so the questioner turns us in a circle, so to speak. Why life? Why me? Hmm? Why me? Why life?
It's not a circle, it's a spiral.
Yeah, and the stimulating questions that we're getting here in the topic is very interesting because incipient in all of this is the answer, meaning that the answer is there. And
well,
we have to search for it.
Well, we ourselves, just by asking a question, should realize at that moment that we're ready to begin to deal with the answer. And way in the back. Yeah.
Well, sometimes when we're thinking about the fact that there's more to us than the special me.
You're special. Okay.
In addition to a lot of this universal impress, we've come through early pre-literate experiences in this incarnation and the tapes are still playing, there's ants in our head, automatic negative thoughts and sensations.
My.
Sometimes it helps just to, why life, why me, be the subject and the object, and consider when one of these automatic negative thoughts or sensations comes into the mind, to hesitate and say, why? Is this real, or is this something that came from outside? Should I reject this?
As Alexander Pope said, the correct study of man is man. We should be students of ourselves. And we're studying cycles right now in the ocean. And it really is important, if you have any hope to make big changes, is to keep a chart of your own cycles, your cycles of moods, your cycles of physical health, your cycles of whatever. And keep a record of it, and you will begin to see there is a rhythm there, which means it isn't you any more than when you look at a chart of the weather. It isn't you. It is what is coming to you from nature. You are experiencing it. And if you really realize that, you can step back from it and alter the way you react in the experience. It is such a simple thing to do, and yet we neglect to do it because we're so busy with this world and not with our real study assignment. We're here for a purpose, and that purpose is to learn. Yes?
Excuse me, before we end it, maybe we don't have too much time to...
No, we have almost 5 minutes.
From the lesson today, I would like to ask that final question. Then, what should be our attitude toward science, religion, changes, and evolution? Because it seemed to me that without the science, we do not evolve. But yet, you mentioned that from the beginning, it's all about evolution also. And also those will be my final thoughts. You know, maybe on the next session, we may have the time to think about that. Because it seemed to me there's a negative tendencies. I mean, if I want to study theosophy, so I should almost like abnegate science, forget about
all
the
right,
science.
All right, no, let's get to that, because that's very important. That is not what theosophy is saying. It is saying respect science and what it is able to show us about matter. Okay. Reject the conclusion unless you come to it yourself.
Okay.
If you believe that life is a material thing and nothing more, that when the body dies, the consciousness is gone, if you believe that that consciousness that each one of us has is a byproduct of the molecules of the brain, then you have to agree with science completely. But if you don't accept that, you are willing to take what they teach and then add that to the wisdom that you can achieve through the spiritual ideas. Remember, it isn't science or religion the way we have it in the West. Theosophy says, no. It is two different ways of looking at the same thing. It's science and religion brought together through philosophy. So we do not reject religion. We reject dogmatic ideas. This last question.
Both science and scientists and religionists are us.
Yes.
And like us, they share the same thing. And what they share is they are works in progress. You cannot make a complete diagnosis because you're not at the point where everything is fine. We are works in progress, whether we're scientists or religionists.
Well, the problem is not that we are works in progress, but that people declare they have the complete answer. You were going to conclude for us?
I already read that.
Yeah.
No, I already read it.
Oh, you already read it. I have a little something from one of the Upanishads. The Supreme Self knows its oneness with the Supreme Eternal and sees nothing apart from the Eternal except the unreality of all else. And we have to come to the point where we say, I am a spiritual being. I am indestructible. I am life. I am me just for the moment. I am I at all times. Meeting is adjourned. What?